Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You have a favorite color, right? Okay, picture a paint chip in that exact shade. Now imagine it surrounded by all the many colors on the wall at the hardware store. Do you still like yours best? Are you sure? Okay, fine, but can you explain why? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Unless we've suffered brain damage, seriously, humans are prone to preferences in food, music, fashion, room temperature, reading materials, leisure activities, just about everything. These differences in what we enjoy feel innate. I just like red because I like it. But in fact, our proclivities are very much shaped by our experiences and by the opinions of those around us, whether or not they happen to reflect our own. Author Tom Vanderbilt explores all this in a book called You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. The book is out now in paperback, and Tom Vanderbilt joins us to talk about it from the studios of NPR in New York. Tom, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
What is taste exactly?
well, that's a huge question, but I think I like to think of taste as basically a way of filtering the world. We, you know, especially in this day and age, we have so many things out there coming to us, things to buy, things to watch, to listen to read, that, you know, it gets a little overwhelming. So we sort of naturally begin to put boundaries around things to only let, you know, sort of some of those things come in. I just think it makes life a bit easier. And we equally put things on the other side of that boundary that, well, that's not something I like. But one of the things I really try to explore in the book is that, well, maybe sometimes those are kind of arbitrary distinctions that don't hold up over time. So, I mean, that's just my basic kind of simple explanation.
One thing that you discovered is that our tastes are categorical. So I might tell you I love cinnamon on everything, but I probably don't want it sprinkled on my mashed potatoes.
Yeah, I think categories are a huge way that we think about and process the world. And, you know, taste is inherently contextual and categorical. There are things, for example, breakfast. It's been sort of pointed out that when you wake up, you kind of reach for a handful of comfort foods. People aren't very adventurous at breakfast. There are things they'll do at dinner that, you know, they'll kind of go out and eat some new cuisine, experiment a little. But that breakfast, you know, really prefer, you don't wake up in an adventure-seeking mood. You just want, you know, basic sustenance, I think. But categories are sort of huge, and a huge way we view the world. We put these, for example, you know, songs into genres, and sometimes a song seems to straddle a few genres, and it might do better with some people if it's labeled country. It might do better with other people if it's labeled rock. But often, before we even had a chance to hear that actual song, just that genre or category label on top of it will really influence our thinking. And I think reflects the way we really are top-down creatures. When I say that, I mean, we like to think we go through the world sort of seeing everything as it is and deciding whether we like it or not, but really we're walking around with a big set of labels in our head of things that we already know we like, and when we see something that conforms to that, it reinforces that, and if we see something outside of that, we instantly sort of write it off, and it takes a little bit more work to come to like that.
Is it possible that taste is somehow inherent in our DNA?
Well, I mean, there are certain things we are born liking as humans. I mean, humans just have a preference for sweet objects because they help us live. When you say DNA, you know, there are things that are, you know, kind of inherited. Inherited is probably the wrong word. That liking is learning, as I like to say in the book, and we begin learning what we like inside of our mother's womb. I mean, the food that she eats, the music she listens to, all those things are actually sort of, you know, kind of percolating down in there, and we are exposed to those things. So infants whose mothers had, you know, a lot of garlic, for example, they do later on do studies with infants and find that infants have a preference to, no surprise, garlic. So it's kind of a lifelong learning process, but it begins even before we're actually out in the world. And these things, it's sort of fascinating how subconsciously these tastes continue to exist. One of my favorite studies looked at, there was a county fair in Germany, and they had different brands of ketchup, and they had people sample these different ketchup brands, but really they were the same ketchup, but to one, a little bit of vanilla had been added. Turned out a certain number of people liked the vanilla one, other people preferred the one without vanilla. the researchers kind of dug a little bit deeper, and it turns out the people who liked the vanilla were the ones who, by and large, had been formula-fed as infants. And in Germany, no surprise, vanilla was one of the flavors used in infant formula. Those people that were not formula-fed preferred the other ketchup without the vanilla. So it's unlikely they would have sort of been aware of this long-lasting vanilla preference, but, you know, there it was. It was kind of deep in their memory.
It's kind of a silly thing that everybody has a favorite color, but it's really common for us to say that we prefer one color over the others.
Yeah, and I can't decide if that's because we're sometimes asked. It seems irresponsible. Yeah, it seems irresponsible to say, no, I like them all. And this was actually what got me started on the book, because my daughter asked me one morning walking to school what my favorite color was, and I immediately had an answer, which was blue. And blue is really not a really radical choice. In fact, it's the color that most people, when pressed for an answer, pick, you know, blue. And I should say this is, you know, when asked for an overall favorite color, this could get into categories again where you say, well, what's your favorite car color? That might be different. But when asked out of a range of the colors that we know, what's your favorite? People, for as long as psychologists have been asking this question, have said blue. And it got me to thinking, you know, is blue really my favorite color? Is this just some weird habit that I have that I just am too lazy to change my, you know, fashion around, or it just seems easiest, or do I really have this authentic liking for blue? Started to wonder about where this could come from, and I went to visit a guy named Stephen Palmer at the University of California, Berkeley, who runs a lab there and has a great theory that he calls ecological valence, and it basically says, to try to put it simply, that we come to like the colors of the things in the world we have the most positive associations toward. I'm talking about the natural world. So blue, a couple pretty powerful connotations there. Blue skies. We're surrounded by blue skies on days that it's sunny. And that is associated with, you know, a positive mood and just general sort of, you know, upbeat way of life. And, of course, water. I mean, oceans, seas, who does not need water to survive? You check into a hotel, you're going to pay more for a waterfront view than the garden view. Water, which often looks blue to us, just makes us feel good. So, yeah, this argument, you know, that perhaps that was why blue sort of comes out on top. We just had this lifelong adaptation of coming to feel good about blue because it seems to be linked up with so many things that make us feel good. You know, people like red as well, but red can have other negative connotations such as blood or sort of gore. But blue, it's kind of hard to find really negative associations with blue.
You don't meet too many people who say their favorite color is like a browny, mustardy yellow shade, but it turns out a lot of babies really like that color.
Yeah, this was fascinating about Palmer's research. You know, he if you want to say that blue must just be this inherent human preference, well, then infants must come into the world loving blue. But he has done experiments with them, showing them these color chips, and they're not really that interested in blue. The color they look at the most, which is how they sort of measure what they prefer, is this brownish-yellowish spectrum. And what's interesting about that is that that comes to be totally inverted by the time we're adults. Those brownish-yellow spectrum comes to sit at the bottom of our color preference, you know, sort of chart, and blue rises to the top. So this is kind of taps into this theory that it's really a learning process, not some thing that we're basically born with, at least in terms of color preference.
Tom, very few of us consciously acquire a preference for things because our peers like them. So how much are we influenced by the reaction of people around us?
I mean, I would say hugely. I mean, humans are socially imitative creatures. We, perhaps the most on the planet. I mean, when people use the verb to ape something, it's kind of has a negative connotation, like, well, apes are slavish imitators of what other apes do. But it's really humans that do this most robustly. They've done really fascinating experiments with children. And the experimenter shows a child how to sort of open this kind of weird puzzle type thing. And the people will follow it more. The kids follow it very closely. And then they'll do it again. And I'm trying to remember how this goes now. Basically, what turns out is that when kids don't really know why they're doing what they're doing, they'll follow even more closely. It's in the absence of information, humans look to other humans for models of how to behave, and I think that kind of explains a lot of our consumer marketplace. There's, you know, there's so many choices to make. We feel overwhelmed, so we look at what other people are doing. This doesn't mean we're totally slavish, though. There's something that psychologists have identified called optimal distinctiveness, which means that, you know, we all want to feel like we belong to this larger group of humans or people in our kinship or tribe or what have you, but we also want to feel like we're individuals, especially in sort of modern Western democracy. So there's sort of this happy sweet spot where, you know, we feel like we belong, yet we can eke out our own identity. And you can think, you know, if they've done studies where a person buys a car and then they find out their neighbor has bought the very same car, and this actually doesn't make them feel that good. you could think where it actually would, but, you know, people feel like their little individuality has been compromised. So we're kind of seeking this this sweet spot, I think, between belonging and being unique.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Tom Vanderbilt. His book is called You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. We'll come back to our conversation with Tom in a couple of minutes. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can make a contribution to KERA and be part of the formula that keeps your favorite radio station strong and vibrant by calling 1-888-694-6931 or going online to make your contribution at KERA.org. Stephen Becker has just stepped into the studio. He, of course, is producer of The Think Show. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Chris. What a fascinating conversation. I always thought, particularly this favorite color thing, that's like the first thing that anybody asks you as a kid, you know, when you have like nothing else to contribute. It's like, what's your favorite color, you know? And we always have an answer. And I never really thought about why did, you know, blue
Why'd
jump
you settle
to mind
on that?
Or whatever. Yeah, good question. So, you know, this is the type of conversation that we like having here on The Think Show. I think some of our favorite shows are the ones where we listen to the guest and we're like, you know, I never really thought about that before. And this is, of course, one of those. It's the type of conversation that you get 5 days a week now here on KERA. We're on an additional show on Friday, as many of you all know now, from 1 to 2. And we're able to do that through your very generous help and your financial contributions. We only ask for your help just a few times a year, and this is one of those times. So we're hoping that you will help out KERA with a contribution at kera.org or at 888-694-6931. Get those numbers mixed up sometimes.
Lots of ways that we can say thank you besides just with our voices and with the programming that you hear when you go online or even when you call in. You can ask about thank you gifts. We have the Anything You Ever Wanted to Know bicycle lock that I believe is new this time around. Jeff Whittington, of course, is known for rarely driving to work. He takes his bike in, so this has been inspired by him. That's available with a sustaining gift of $7.50 a month or a $90 one-time gift. I suppose it's endorsed by Jeff Whittington. And this is the kind of lock that comes with a key, not with a combination, just FYI. So nothing to remember.
Very useful. Yeah, I'm sure Jeff has probably gone ahead and contributed to get one of those because, you know, as we've said many times here, not only do we work here, but we're also members of the station. I know that I am. I know you are, Chris. I promise you Jeff is. And we're hoping that you'll join us because, you know, we understand that the station exists through the very generous donations of listeners. That's why we put our money into it. We hope that you'll join us with a contribution at 888-694-6931 or at kera.org. We have a goal of hearing from 40 KERA listeners during this hour. That's going to keep things moving along and make sure that we can wrap up this drive in a reasonable amount of time.
40's a lot, but you just have to be one of those contributors, and we know that you will feel great about it when you do it because that makes you a patron of The Think Show. Every time you turn on the radio, you can say, I helped to make this show possible. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Tom Vanderbilt.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can pursue their passion. You can study social justice and build activism skills with summer courses like education, equality, and human rights. You can apply now at smu.edu/mls.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Tom Vanderbilt about his book You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Tom, there's figuring out what we like, and then there are the people trying to figure out what we like. I am fascinated by those music discovery sites that use algorithms to discover what I like based on what I have liked in the past. Can you talk a little bit about the information that they're collecting to figure this out?
Sure, yeah. This is one of the fascinating things about taste nowadays, is that we really have access in real time to what people are doing and at a micro level. If you don't like a movie, you stop watching it one third of the way through. Netflix knows that. If you don't like this song, you skip it right away. Spotify knows that. A lot of very careful work has to go into this, because it can be very difficult to tease out what people want from their behavior. I mean, a great example was at the website Pandora, there was a band called Fun, and the song was We Are Young. And it was featured on Glee, the movie, but the song had been kind of kicking around Pandora for a few years with other sorts of fans. But then it kind of got this boost and was put into pop culture, and it brought a bunch of new people to hear that one song. The question of what to play next for those people was a very different one for the new fans versus the older fans who had been sort of more of like, you know, indie pop kind of people. But just determining from one song what a person likes is very tricky. You know, people's moods change. They may not want the same thing. So I spent some time with a group called the Echo Nest, which is kind of an intelligence company that Spotify later acquired. And they really drill down into stuff very carefully in an interesting way. And for that reason, I think if anyone uses Spotify out there, there's the weekly discovery function. It's gotten a lot better. It used to just be sort of a very predictable list of things that you mostly already listen to. And this is one of the problems. You know, how do you give someone what they like yet give them a little taste of novelty? And, you know, too much in either direction can be bad and get people to basically, you know, not engage.
Selections on Netflix always have stars next to them from user reviews, but it turns out people sometimes rate movies the way they think they should be rated, as opposed to as a reflection of how they actually felt about the movie.
Exactly. And I should say that those stars are sort of going into the historical dustbin. I mean, Netflix has now decided it's basically easier and more useful for their purposes to simply go with a thumbs up or thumbs down. And this was kind of disappointing to me, because I used to spend a lot of time on these. I would watch a movie and then, you know, kind of, well, was it a 4-star or 3.5? You know, because you think, well, that's going to determine what they're going to present to me as recommendations. But there, again, there's a lot of statistical noise in those choices, so it just seemed easier for them to have sort of a broad like or dislike. But it turns out, you know, one of the things they've learned now that Netflix has a lot more streaming activity, it can really see in real time what people are doing. You know, what people say they like does not always match up so well with what they really like. So, you know, you're giving Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth 5 stars, yet, you know, that
you never
DVD
finished
sat
it
at your house for a month, right? Exactly. And you turned out there's a lot of things you watched but didn't rate or rated negatively, but you actually watched the whole thing and then gave it 1 star or something. Hot Tub Time Machine, I don't know. I'm just going to pick on that. But, you know, and so there's – even on Netflix, where people can't really see your choices, I think there's a certain level of self-deception going on, that people are trying to present this best image of themselves, even if it doesn't match up with their behavior. And why are they self-deceiving? Well, the argument from some psychologists that self-deception helps you deceive others, to kind of present that better vision of yourself to other people. So it's kind of a tricky thing. But again, these are just some of the things Netflix has to deal with.
So if I want to admit to you that I loved Hot Tub Time Machine, I will call it a guilty pleasure, which is like this way I give myself a pass for liking something that seems socially unacceptable for some reason.
Yeah, I find that phrase very fascinating. I'm not, you know, sure if the pleasure actually comes from the guilt, or you feel guilty because of the pleasure. And it's just a way that, again, we give sort of license. And I feel like it's a bit of a wink, because if it was something we really felt bad about, I think that would be... psychologists have distinguished between guilt and shame. And shame is something, shame is sort of the really bad stuff that you would not admit to anyone that you watched. But, you know, we sort of say, ah, yeah, it was a guilty pleasure. But, you know, to give ourselves, you know, you want to be able to indulge in the pleasure, yet let yourself off the hook if that person turns out to think poorly of that thing. Or, but it's a very loaded phrase in my mind. And just as an example of this, I looked on Shutterstock, the photo stock site where you can go to get images. And I typed in the word guilty pleasure. I was curious, you know, this is kind of a cultural repository here. What does culture at large think a guilty pleasure is? And it's just, the moment I typed that in, there were pages and pages of basically women eating chocolate or dessert alone and looking kind of, you know, smiling yet looking guilty. So,
because we're supposed to want to eat a salad is kind of the rule, right?
And you're supposed to be laughing. That's another popular meme that's been shown on internet image sites, is, you know, women with laughing with salad. So yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you could have had men drinking beer and eating chicken wings, or, you know, whatever a male guilty pleasure is perceived to be, but no, it was women and chocolate.
Tom, how is it that some things that are not well respected when they're produced, it could be works of art, it could be movies, it could be music, take on a new life as either overlooked masterpieces or cult favorites much, much later?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a couple things potentially going on. One is just that we're sort of torn, just as humans, I think, between things that are, between liking things that are familiar to us and then also craving a certain amount of novelty. But sometimes the novelty can be too novel, and it really seems, you know, disturbing or off-putting. We don't know what to basically do with it as a thing. We haven't learned how to categorize it, how we actually feel about it. It just doesn't touch enough reference points that we're familiar with. Classic example of this would be something like the in art, the Impressionists, which, you know, at the time this work was being produced, it was, you know, could hardly be given away at auction houses, was thought to not be art. If you go and look at what was actually selling a lot at the time, it was very popular. Those works nowadays are, you know, sort of sitting in museums, in places. They're not, you know, unrespected, they're just not popular now, whereas Impressionism is now the art that, you know, people who don't really know much about art know about Impressionism and think they like Impressionism. So that changed entirely, and there were a couple of processes going on there too, though, which is that I think the second part of this is that we often don't know as people or societies how we're going to change in the future. We tend to think our current state is just going to project out unchanged. So a taste would be something like that, where, you know, I like this art now, I'm going to like this art in 30 years. I mean, so, you know, go look at your closet. It doesn't really hold out. There's a lot of things you have to get rid of because you've become sort of a different person. Fashion has moved on. So, you know, art would be subject to the same things. After Impressionism, you know, these historical realist paintings were very popular at the actual time of Impressionism. But then photography came along and suddenly, you know, realist historical stuff didn't really have the same power because photography had taken a lot of energy. So, but no, you know, no one could anticipate that or see that. So, tastes change, and I think that is one of the mechanisms how it happens.
I think that's really interesting, the way tastes change over time. I was thinking about the fact that people are really into mid-century modern design right now, but in the middle of the 20th century, lots of people wanted early American reproductions, which are super out of fashion right now. People in 2017 don't want anything made in the 1950s because they might have, you know, like a rocking chair with an American eagle on it. So tastes change in general over time.
Yeah, and I'm sure some of that mid-century stuff in the early 70s, let's say, or the 1970s could probably hardly be given away. I mean, it sort of probably went through a decline. And I think, you know, again, it taps into these, I think, very broad patterns of novelty and familiarity. It suddenly became novel to a new audience, or maybe there were things about mid-century modern that weren't really appreciated when it came out, but over time people began to see what it was good for, and you had certain taste makers perhaps championing it. Then there's that other thing of distinction and belonging. And if everyone has, you know, old American antique furniture or whatever, you're looking for something different that's somehow, you know, has a cultural cachet that no one else knows about. Some, you know, a few people begin to, hey, let's revisit that mid-century modern stuff and put it out there, and suddenly it's novel yet, you know, sort of familiar to a new batch of people.
How do we use our expression of taste to communicate something about our identity?
I mean, I think it's you know, pretty strong, and it's stronger with certain things. I mean, I think, you know, obviously something like music is one of the most immediate touchstones, especially of kids of around college age to early adulthood, but going on through life. I mean, this is something that we, I think, tend to broadcast a lot more than, say, our food and taste, although there's some argument that, you know, kind of being a foodie has almost become the same thing as being a connoisseur of music or film, that we like to broadcast our taste. And it's something as simple as, you know, ordering a coffee now. You go to a cafe and, you know, if you just sort of ask for coffee, you might be, you know, sort of laughed at depending on the cafe you're in. Do you want single origin? Do you want drip? Do you want nitro cold brewed? You know, coffee became sort of a connoisseurial object unto itself. So, and I'm sorry, I lost track of the original question there in my rant about coffee. But
the idea about identity and like using the things that we like to show something about who we are.
Right, right. And so, I mean, even something as humble as coffee, which was just this basic, you know, commodity. I mean, it's an interesting pattern. At the same time that some things have become democratized, like wine, you can get pretty, you know, good bottle of wine for not that much. Other things have become, you know, more objects of connoisseurial attention, like coffee, which used to just be sort of like Folgers or Maxwell House. And now, and I'm not arguing this is a bad thing, but it becomes yet another way to identify yourself. And at the end of the day, it can get a little exhausting, to my mind, living in a place like Brooklyn, New York, where there's a lot of things that people use to identify themselves. And this can be sort of in a positive sense or a negative sense. By the rejection of that taste, you might be signaling your identity just as strongly. As to why we do it, again, I think just signs of distinction that are fairly easy to signal and fairly cheap, and you know, and it's a shared language that we can all agree on.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is author Tom Vanderbilt. We're talking about his book, You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. The book is out now in paperback. We will come back to the conversation with Tom in a couple of minutes. In the meantime, if you are ready to become a member of KERA or renew your membership, this is a great time to do it. We are looking, started the hour with a goal of 40 contributors, looking for an additional 30. If you would love to read Tom Vanderbilt's book, we do have copies available as a thank you when you make a gift in the amount of $10 a month on a sustaining plan or a $120 one-time gift. It's really interesting. There is so much in here that we will not have time to go into in this hour that just really answers a lot of questions that you may not have even realized you had, which is what Stephen was talking about earlier. And it is our favorite kind of show when we think, I never thought about it, but that's really interesting. And this is the kind of discussion we love to have on Think, the kind of discussion your contributions helps to pay for, and the kind of thing that we think that you are also interested in as a listener of the station.
That whole question about do I like this thing because I like it, or do I like it because somebody else wants me to like it, or am I liking it because I want to impress somebody else? I mean, you can just go down that rabbit hole forever. But we know that you like public radio because it's here for you every day, for one thing, keeps you informed, and it keeps you entertained. You know, if you were one of those people that were driving around on this beautiful weekend we had, listening to maybe Weekend Edition with Scott Simon, or, you know, the many, you know, quiz shows that are on over the weekend, if that was you and it really kind of enhanced that experience this weekend, it's important that we hear from you, because that's how it's going to be able to continue to be brought to you every day and every weekend. You can join the many people who have already contributed today and during this drive with a contribution at KERA.org or by calling 888-694-6931.
Join nice folks like Robin Coffee in Poolville, John Thomas in Dallas, Tracy Young in Carrollton, Leah Schlegel in Keller, Sandy Bowen in Richardson, Cassidy Castillo-Wilson in Duncanville, and Michael Shea in Dallas. Thanks to all those folks, and thanks to you if you are going online or going to the phones now to call 1-888-694-6931.
We also heard from Harvey Lacey in Wiley, who says that KERA is the only radio station his truck knows. those. And also from, let's see, we heard from Nancy Baum in North Richland Hills, Martine Thomas in Arlington, and Natalie Webb in Dallas, who says she loves KERA. She says, I feel like you're my safe place, a place where I can be challenged and a trusted friend in uncertain times. I appreciate your dedication to journalism. Well, thank you, Natalie. It's very nice of you to say. You know, I know that everybody who works here really takes that challenge on as far as being here when there's big news, when there's context that needs to be provided, and also just the, you know, context and global reach of not only NPR, but the BBC World Service, all of those services that we here at KERA really enjoy bringing to you on a daily basis. And we appreciate your part that you play in that, because you are the ones that when you contribute, you are paying directly for that programming to be brought to you. We're asking again for your support. And you can do that, of course, at kera.org, or, of course, by giving a call to 888-694-6931.
We get that it's easy to take KERA for granted, because from the moment you discovered this radio station, it has been here for you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you contributed or not, KERA was here for you. But it's here because at some point along the way, somebody else said, you know what, I can't leave this all up to the other listeners. I have to take responsibility. People make contributions in small amounts, and they make contributions in large amounts, and everywhere in between. But we do sincerely ask everybody who listens, who is able to make a contribution, to make a contribution. For you, that might be $5 a month. For somebody else, it might be $10,000 a year. You know what the amount is, but you do know how much you listen, and that means you have a responsibility.
And I think that's probably the experience for a lot of listeners. You know, you find KERA and you hear that first membership campaign. You're like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that they raised money to run the station. But the truth is, donations that we get from members is the largest source of funding here at the station. We only break into programming just a few times a year to ask for your support. This happens to be one of them. But if you're one of those people who have heard a pledge drive or two and, you know, haven't taken action yet, well, maybe this is the time for you. We would love to hear from you. I mean, it's so exciting to hear from new and sustaining members, to know that there are new folks out there who are listening to the programming and enjoying what they hear. If that's you, it'd be great to hear from you today at 888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Your contribution goes right to work paying for the radio programming that you love. You can tune in anytime and hear whatever amount you donate to the station given right back to you in the form of great radio programming and journalism. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number to become a member, or you can do it online at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for working adults interested in human-centered leadership. You can take courses this fall like Personhood in the Age of Corporate Enterprise. You can apply now at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Tom Vanderbilt about his book, now out in paperback, called You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tom, since reading this book, I've been trying to spot fake online reviews. Are there particular giveaways that we can look for?
Yeah, there was actually a program done by some guys at Cornell, which was looking, trying to identify through a data mining sort of experiment, you know, what were the giveaways to these things. And there were certain things, you know, superlatives with a lot of exclamation marks and just a kind of lack of actual detail. Sort of someone would describe, you know, for a hotel room, they describe what they did in this city or something while they were there, but they didn't actually describe any details of the hotel room, because presumably that was a harder thing to invent. So they actually came up with a fake review detector sort of thing. You can plug in the URL to the review, and it will you know, spit that back out, whether it's true or false. Turns out a lot of them are false. A lot of them are false, but are caught before they ever make it to the site on a place like Yelp. But it is a problem.
Even when people are telling the truth, I'm not always sure that I trust their review, only because I don't know what's really important to them. So, like, if a review says a rental house is perfect, or if it left something to be desired, I want to know more about the person who's leaving that review.
Yeah, and this is one of the huge, I mean, there's a great promise in this democratization of information and opinion. We used to perhaps just rely on a Michelin guide or a AAA guide or some, you know, one authoritative source that, you know, they may have been there on a bad day or a good day. It was only one person doing the review. So there's sort of a power, there's a wisdom of crowd sort of effect there. But again, you know, what is the standard of a good critic? This is a question that goes back to Enlightenment philosophy, people like David Hume. But, you know, not only so are they a good critic or not, but, you know, as you say, what was their standard and what are they actually reviewing? I've had, like many authors, I've had experiences on Amazon where someone gave my book one star and I felt, you know, a bit offended and hurt. But you know, we have thick skins, we authors. But then I looked at the review and it said, well, this book arrived, you know, late and was damaged. And I'm like, okay. So they're giving Amazon a one-star review, not necessarily me, which, you know, but this is the kind of thing. So I've found myself, as you perhaps have as well, trying to find a hotel and staying up late at night, thinking I found the right place. And then all of a sudden, review number 33 says, well, there were bugs in the bathroom. And suddenly I think, well, you know, there goes that choice. Or do I actually trust that person? So it just... You know, there's more information, which is power, but it also, you know, creates yet more things we have to wade through to decide. So it's a bit of, you know, ambivalence there.
I've interviewed a fair number of professional critics over the years, and of course, these jobs sound like a dream come true if we love music or art or wine or whatever. But I've wondered, does having very refined taste make it harder to enjoy things?
Yeah, that's a very good question, one that I was sort of wondering about with beer or wine. I actually went to the Great American Beer Festival, and these were people who are, you know, it was a room of, the tasting room had something like 300 microbrews from across the country, you know, very rare things from Oregon and California that never even make it east of the Mississippi River. And to my mind, it was all a bit overwhelming. And I also wondered, though, at the end of the day, it's just, are you always on this upward trajectory toward wanting the next best elusive thing? And, you know, but I think what those beer tasters told me, the professionals, were, you know, no, I mean, there are ways. At the end of the day, they often just want like a simple go-to ale or lager, something that, you know, might not be considered the best, but it's sort of a palate cleanser. And I think the key is to, there's been some research on this, is to sort of, is how you present and categorize it. If you sort of, you know, if you go to an airport expecting a gourmet meal, you know, you may be disappointed when you eat at a restaurant there. But if you kind of go in like, well, it's an airport, how good is it going to be? If you ratchet your expectations to a certain level, then you can begin to enjoy it, you know, for sort of what it is. And I think we get into trouble when we sort of try to lump things all along a spectrum. And this is why you see, you know, very, very specific fragmenting sometimes going on, even at that beer festival where they had... You know, they had some beers that are not considered top beers by sort of the cognoscenti, like, you know, sort of a Bud Light, but they have a category for, you know, American lager, and then it gets put in that, and then they can figure out, well, what's the best American lager under this criteria. So, but it is a question, you know, I don't think it's actually been answered, but it is a danger, I think, that, you know, it's harder to go down, I think, than up once you're sort of in a connoisseurial mindset.
My husband's in charge of mowing the lawn, so I hadn't heard this term before, but lawnmower beer is a great term that I think I'll remember.
Yeah, and it's sort of, you know, I mean, back when I was in college, we had, you know, these cases of beer you could buy for, you know, $6 or something. And you know, what was it, the greatest beer ever? No, but, you know, did it fit our budget and our taste requirements, you know, at the time? You know, yes, indeed. So, you know, we were quite happy about it. And, you know, sometimes, if you're hot, I mean, this kind of speaks to a sense that taste is very contextual and often changes in the very course of a meal, I would argue. I mean, there's a great sensation. It's called sensory-specific satiety. And this is a thing that happens to people that once you begin eating something, your liking for it begins to diminish the moment you start eating it. And by the time you're sort of like full, what's really happening, it's less about the fact that you're actually full that or that you're satiated, but your liking has actually diminished so much for that thing that you simply don't want to eat it anymore. And we know that it's not really a question of being full, in quotes, because the minute something else comes along that's different, like dessert, suddenly we have, you know, this room, this new appetite for this thing. So I think, you know, even over the course of a meal, the way we feel about things actually undergoes this change. So this is one of the lessons about taste, I think, that it really may not be as on solid footing as we think it is.
I'm curious about the phenomenon of liking on social media. I'll ask you, do you think of a like as a sign of approval or an acknowledgement that you have viewed something?
That's a great question. I sometimes wonder when I'm looking at my Instagram feed, for example, whether it would almost be just as easy to thumb every picture as I touch it to scroll up as it would to sit and actually analyze, do I like this or not? Because, I mean, and this sort of represents how easy it is to like something on social media and how sort of, as a currency, it's a pretty cheap thing. I mean, there's not a lot of time or investment that has to go into that. So as a signal, it's a bit weird. But likes on social media give me all sorts of problems, as they have some of the companies involved. I mean, Facebook had to do this really extensive research with academic anthropologists to sort of figure out, you know, can we say things beyond just thumbs up or and Facebook has avoided a dislike button for a long time, but then they wanted to go beyond that, you know, because if you put up a picture of let's just say a news announcement of someone that died, a favored musician or something, I mean, do you like that? I mean, that doesn't really seem like an appropriate response. What is the appropriate response beyond, you know, writing something? And so I think it's something that all these companies have had to deal with, and even trying to understand what people mean by going back to the stars and thumbs question. Some people, like YouTube, used to have a star rating system, but they found that people were basically treating it like a thumb up or thumb down. They either gave one star or five stars. So YouTube decided it was just as easy to, you know, thumb up or thumb down. So I think it speaks to the idea that we're not really spending a lot of time thinking through these things. These are very gut level responses, I think, that you know, how we feel about something. And even though Facebook now has eight or so emoticon style things that you can choose from.
Is there such a thing as objectively bad taste?
I don't think so. I mean, there are things that trigger disgust in humans that are universal. And Paul Rozin at the University of Pennsylvania has done a lot of great research into this, and you know, there's great experiments in which, you know, once a cockroach has been seen in a bowl, and then even if that bowl is washed, people will not eat from that bowl. I mean, there's certain things relating to basically our health and fear of disease that trigger these disgust things. But beyond that, it's a pretty hard argument to make. I think, you know, many things that were denounced as bad taste in their day now represent paragons of good taste. This is just really a social consensus among a certain group that comes up at a certain time that happens to, you know, bestow a good thing upon a group of objects, but that can easily change over time, go in and out like mid-century modern furniture. So only with disgust do I think we have that kind of universal negative aspect.
Tom Vanderbilt's latest book is called You May Also Like, Taste in an Age of Endless Choice. The book is out now in paperback. Tom, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you listening today. We really appreciate you being part of the show every day when we do it. We especially want to thank those of you who have made contributions to the station so far this hour. We started with a goal of 40 contributions. We have 21 to go. If you're thinking, well, I've already made a contribution for this year, maybe you can just switch your contribution. Go from being a one-time-a-year member to a sustaining member. That is really terrific for us because we can count on your support through the years. Maybe you've been at the level of, say, $10 a month and thought that's working great, and you can do 15 or 20. You can make those changes and be counted against our goal of contributions for this hour. 888-694-6931 is the number, or kera.org. And you may also like to receive a copy of You May Also Like, Tom Vanderbilt's new book.
I was thinking, what a cool book that would be to kind of read with your kids, you know, like when you're young. Is when you feel like you kind of develop your tastes and your likes, and How interesting would that be to kind of pick your kids' brains about how they're developing the things that they're into from a actual, you know, scientific standpoint instead of just, you know, what happens to, you know, come to the top of mind? We'd be happy to send you Tom's book again for a $120 contribution. And you'll be doing your part to bring public radio to North Texas and also to help us tick away at this goal this hour. As you said, Chris, we're hoping to hear from 40 folks. We're right about halfway there, but we only have a few minutes left in the hour. So it's important that we hear from you now. 888-694-6931 is one way you can reach us, or, of course, KERA.org.
We're obtaining more and more listeners over time, in part because we have lots of different ways for you to listen. You used to be able to just listen on the radio. Now we have lots going on online. We have stories that we put on the NPR One app. You might stream. You might take a podcast. All of those things are because we want to serve you how you want the content. We want to be able to give it to you. They come with a cost. Additional listeners come with a cost because we pay for the programs we subscribe to that are produced somewhere else according to how many people are in our listenership. And it doesn't matter to them if only 10% of those folks actually make contributions. They're going to charge more as our numbers go up. So if you've been listening for a long time, enjoy the station, believe that you wouldn't know what to do without it, this is a good time to make a contribution at 888-694-6931 or KERA.org.
Some of those people who have made contributions include Emily Booth of Fort Worth, who says that KERA is a great way for me to keep up with my community, state, country, and news around the world. Thinking other programs are a bright spot in my day during the week. Thank you, Emily. We also heard from Neff Connor in Bedford, who said, KERA is my go-to source for radio news. With original programs like Think, KERA contextualizes national and international events for North Texas listeners. Boy, it sounds like Neff took the talking points and gave them right back to us. I'm glad people are listening. Thanks so much to both of those people, and we'd love to have you join them with a contribution, of course, at KERA.org. That's where you can take a look at all of the thank you gifts available during this drive. One of the really popular ones has actually been this t-shirt that we've had for a drive or two, but it's been really popular, so we keep bringing it back. It's the KERA Texas flag Go Public t-shirt. It's good for a $90 one-time gift or just $7.50 a month on the sustaining membership plan. Just imagine if you wore that t-shirt once a month. You know, it would cost you $7.50. You can show your support for North Texas. It's actually a really cool-looking shirt. You can take a look at it at KERA.org, which is where you can pick one up and make that contribution.
Is it true that you can get away with listening to KERA and never making a contribution? Yes. But so many of you, this is the miraculous thing, so many of you make contributions just because you know it's the right thing to do, because you know that somebody has to make a contribution, and you're not the sort of person who wants to sort of cynically leave that up to somebody else. You say, I want to be part of what's good about this community rather than someone who is just waiting for another person to take on my responsibility. We know there are lots of you out there who haven't yet made a contribution to KERA, but who are the kind of person who will. Why not make that day today at 888-694-6931 or at KERA.org.
And Chris, that is one of the secrets that, yes, you can get away without contributing. But another of the one of the secrets is that when you do contribute, you feel really good that you did. I promise you, you'll have this little glow the rest of the day because you'll know that you brought this service not only to yourself, but to people all across North Texas, regardless of their ability to contribute. And that, I think, is a thing that's going to make you feel great. 888-694-6931 is one place you can contribute, or visit us online at KERA.org.
Get the pledge glow.